So continuing to explore our text. Gil talked last night around, or yesterday afternoon, around the looking at our shortcomings as essentially a path, part of our path. And it's not separate from our path to explore these challenges, these difficult states of mind. And in fact, our wisdom grows as we bring a particular kind of knowing to our difficult states. And this is the kind of knowing that we're cultivating, the kind of mindfulness that we're cultivating here on retreat. And Gil talked this morning about how we hold our experience. It doesn't matter so much what the experience is, but how we relate to it, how we are with it, is the key. And that that is the kind of knowing that cultivates wisdom, that cultivates understanding. And that understanding itself, the wisdom, as the wisdom grows in us, it becomes very natural to abandon these shortcomings, these difficulties. Sometimes as a natural release simply through the seeing itself, and sometimes through a more conscious, I know this is not helpful, that kind of firm, no, enough. But in any case, the wisdom allows us to abandon without aversion, without hatred, but the wisdom allows us to abandon with skill. It becomes very natural to let go of things that we see are not valuable to us. And from this, the sutta goes on, basically, when one has known that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, and has abandoned it, and he goes on through all of the states here, all of the 16 imperfections, shortcomings, when one essentially has known these as shortcomings that stain the mind, that cloud our judgment, and has abandoned them, one acquires perfect confidence in the Buddha, perfect confidence in the Dharma, and perfect confidence in the Sangha. Perfect confidence in the Buddha, that the Buddha found a path, that the Buddha found a peace, found liberation, freedom from struggle, freedom from suffering. Confidence that the Buddha actually found that. One gets a confidence or acquires a confidence in the teaching of the Buddha. The Buddha said, I found this peace, and I also found a way to tell you how to find it for yourselves. And that's his Dharma, his teaching. And so this acquiring this confidence includes acquiring confidence in that, in those teachings. But it's not just in the teachings, because it is the teachings themselves don't have the power to free us. Reading the words, simply reading the words or hearing the words isn't usually enough, although there are some instances in the texts where somebody hears the Buddha speak and understands something very deeply and has a realization. But the understanding when that happens is that as someone is listening, they are engaging in the moment with the teachings. They're actually practicing what he's saying in the moment. Because it is the acting on, the engaging with the teachings that frees us. The wisdom that grows with the engagement with the teachings. And so it's confidence that the teachings point the way, and confidence in their efficacy, in their power to support this freedom, support this wisdom. And confidence in the Sangha, confidence that there are others out there who have also followed this path that can support us, that are worthy of listening to, worthy of respect. And so the sutta describes that having seen these imperfections and abandoned them, this perfect confidence arises. So I will explore this perfect confidence, but first I want to explore confidence. How confidence works in our practice. Because most of us don't come into practice with perfect confidence. We come in perhaps with, nothing else is working, maybe this will help. And that was kind of my approach when I started this practice. And so I'd like to start with this, an exploration of faith and confidence. There are two words in the Pali that are related, I think. One is sada, which is the typical word that's translated as faith or conviction, belief, trust, sometimes also translated as confidence. But Bhikkhu Bodhi uses faith, I believe, for sada, and then another word he uses for confidence, the word that is used in this text, which is pasada. So I think the words may be etymologically related, pasada and sada. The pasada is usually translated as something like confidence. And the places, I haven't done a complete review of this, we can check with Gil about this, but I haven't done a complete review of this, but the places where I've seen the word pasada used, it seems to refer to a confidence that has some knowledge to it, some understanding behind it, some verification or some verified sense of, yeah, I know this for myself. Whereas faith may be used in places, I think it's used in both contexts, but it's also used in places where there may not be that verified sense of, I know this for myself. It's something we are taking on faith, something we are, a wisdom that we are borrowing essentially from others. And this is how our practice begins. So the word faith, often I think translating sada as faith, trust is, I think, my favorite word for this quality, having a trust in the teachings, having a trust in my ability to engage. Faith, the word faith, I think some of us may have already have a relationship with that word, and for myself it wasn't a very friendly relationship. I equated it with blind faith, or faith in something that there would be no way to verify. And so I had a kind of relationship with that word. In the context of Buddhist understanding, Buddhist practice, the faith that we engage in, there's always faith in something, right? It's not just faith in the abstract. What is it that we're asked to have faith in this practice? And this what we're asked to have faith in relates to the whole exploration, the whole journey that the Buddha made. His whole inquiry was about, is there a way to be free of suffering? He looked out at the world, he looked at his own life, and he saw so much struggle, so much suffering, and that was his impetus for his own journey, his own spiritual practice. Is there a way to get free of this suffering? And in his own exploration, he found a way. He found the possibility, first, the possibility of freedom from suffering, and that freedom that he came to, it also came in his mind, thank goodness for us, an articulation of how he might communicate that freedom to others, how he might communicate his own journey and his own process to others, that they might engage in that process themselves. It's said that in the case of the Buddha, he discovered this path without help. He discovered it without Sangha, without anyone to point the way to him. And it's said that it's a very rare being that can do that. All of us have the benefit of having the teachings of the Buddha to learn from, to listen to. We have the benefit of having people who've gone through this and worked with it in their own minds and can articulate, hey, this is what I did, why don't you try this? The Buddha didn't have that. It's said to be a very rare being who can find this freedom for themselves, and then to be even rarer, even more rare, to be able to articulate that. What we can do. And so what we're encouraged to explore, encouraged to have faith in, or to take on faith, is that there is this possibility for freedom, and that there's a way that we can do it. So there is some leap of faith necessary, at least for me. You know, when I first started this, as I said, you know, it's like, I don't see how this is going to work. You know, actually, when I very first started this practice, I was pretty miserable. I was so caught in anger and didn't see a way out of it. And somebody sent me a book on Buddhist practice, and I didn't understand much of what was said in the book, actually, but I kind of got one little bit of information out of that book. It said, try observing your emotions, just being with them, rather than acting on them. And I read that and I thought, what good is that going to do? What good is it going to do to be with my anger? Won't that just make me more angry? But in some fortunate way, I was actually at the bottom of my, I was kind of hit bottom. And it's like, well, I'm willing to try anything here. I have no idea how this is going to work, but I'm willing to try it. And so this is the beginning of faith. This is a kind of, you know, the faith might just be hearing something and being willing to give it a go, being willing to try it, willing to explore it. I didn't have much sense of trust that it would work, but I had this book. I guess what I took trust in was that I had this book, and I had a friend who said, hey, this has really helped me. So I kind of borrowed my friend's trust, in a way. Borrowed that confidence that my friend had and said, okay, let's see what happens. So this willingness to engage, this is the kind of the first step of faith. We hear something, we hear a teaching, and we've had perhaps an encounter with suffering, and that teaching, those two things come together, and we take a step, take the first steps onto the path. Bhikkhu Bodhi says that suffering, well, actually, the Buddha, in the teachings of the Buddha, he says that largely our spiritual journey begins with a contact with suffering. And that suffering will lead to either a search for some kind of freedom from that suffering, a search for a way out of that suffering. His words are, does anyone know a way or two out of this suffering? So meeting suffering leads to that kind of search, or he said it leads to bewilderment. And I think this often happens to us, that we get confused when we suffer. It's like, why me? What did I do wrong? Bhikkhu Bodhi's exploration of this question of suffering leading to faith, he articulates it beautifully. I'll read this to you. He says, suffering impels us to seek the way to liberation. So suffering is called the supporting condition for faith. By itself, however, the confrontation with suffering, even at the level of mature reflection, is not sufficient to generate faith. For faith to arise, two conditions are required. The first is the awareness of suffering, which makes us recognize the need for a path. That's the search. We recognize the need for a path. Does someone know a way or two out of this suffering? The second is the encounter with the teaching that proclaims a path of freedom. And so we need this encounter with the teaching, encounter with some wisdom. And the Buddha offers this to us. He offers this teaching. The classic wisdom, the classic framing of wisdom in the Buddhist teaching is the Four Noble Truths. And so in a way, we're asked to invest our confidence in the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the truth that suffering has a cause, craving, the truth that it's possible for this suffering to come through an end. The ending of craving is the ending of suffering. And the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path leading to the ending of suffering. So investing our confidence, investing our faith in these truths isn't about just believing them. It's not about just saying, okay, yep, I believe that. Yep, suffering, okay, yep, I believe that. Many of us are ready to believe that. There is suffering. The Buddha asks us to go a step further than simple belief and asks us to engage with these truths. He offers us actions to go with each of these truths. He suggests that we need to understand suffering. Understanding meaning not in the intellectual way, but in this way we're exploring here. What Gil talked about last night is essentially exploring this first noble truth. How do we understand, get to know our shortcomings, our suffering, our struggles? This is the exploration of the first noble truth and what we're asked, how we are asked to engage. And so one of the qualities of faith, one of the supports it offers us on our practice is that we do become willing to engage rather than simply
read or listen to something, hoping that some kind of magic will happen to us. We are asked to engage. And so understanding suffering, understanding that turning towards meeting with mindfulness, our anger, our frustration, our confusion, our ill will, our greed, all of those qualities that were listed yesterday, understanding them is the first step on the path. Understanding them. The second noble truth, the action that is we're encouraged to explore with respect to the second noble truth, is to let go of the cause of suffering. We could use the word of our sutta, abandon the cause of suffering. And it's, at first, that abandonment may be kind of conscious. Recognizing, yeah, this isn't so helpful. Let me set that aside. And we set it aside over and over and over again, consciously letting go of some habit of mind, consciously not now and turning to something else. That may be the first step of our path with abandoning. And eventually, what I've understood and seen in my own experience is that the understanding that comes with that first noble truth, when suffering is fully understood, it's like the mind sinks into and understands the whole of that pattern, the whole of that structure of suffering. It understands how it's put together. And as the mind fully understands suffering, the mind naturally begins to abandon it. At deeper stages of our practice, the abandoning starts to happen through the wisdom. Wisdom has developed, the understanding deepens, and wisdom grows, and it is wisdom that does the letting go. Wisdom lets go of these defilements. So those are the first two noble truths. Understand suffering. Abandon, let go of the cause of suffering. The third is to realize the release, realize the ending of suffering. Open to the freedom, the peace that comes, even in moments. Even in moments we feel a sense of release, a sense of freedom, a sense of maybe for just a moment we can observe anger without being caught by it. Maybe for just a moment we can know, oh, this is just anger. And we feel a shift of relationship to that experience. We feel a shift. And that shift is some spaciousness, some ease. We're no longer caught and kind of entwined in, identified with the state of difficulty. And it's simply, oh, there's something happening in the mind. That shift is a taste of that realizing the release. We feel for ourselves the ease, the freedom, the relaxation of mind around that. And then the fourth noble truth, to cultivate the path, to engage in these practices. The cultivating the path is technically referring to the Eightfold Path, cultivating wise understanding, wise intention, ethical conduct, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, and the meditative work, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. Those are the tools that allow us to understand suffering and let go of the cause, and subsequently realize the release. So at the beginning, faith is kind of more taken on faith. We borrow faith. We hear the teachings. We may be willing to engage, willing to, as I put it to my mind, I'm willing to run this experiment. It's kind of like this initial kind of faith is almost like a scientific hypothesis. You're not sure it's true, but you're willing to give it a go. You're willing to run the experiment. So we can hold the Four Noble Truths and the actions associated with them almost as a hypothesis. What would happen if I explored understanding suffering? And that, to me, is really the main work of our practice, to understand suffering. And we begin to see, as we do that, the benefits. So what is initially taken on faith, what is initially simply, like in my experience, of, wow, I have no idea how that's going to work, but wow, I'll give it a try. Nothing else has worked. I mean, that was what my mind said, you know. I've tried everything else for happiness, and I thought I knew how to be happy in this life, but I guess I don't. I had kind of like done some things in my life, and I actually had, in the few months before that, I thought, wow, I figured it out. I figured life out. I know how I can be happy. And then something happened, and it was like, no. And that's when I kind of hit bottom. So it's like, okay, I thought I knew. I have no idea. So, you know, if somebody tells me, watch your anger, watch your emotions, I'm willing to give that a try. And I committed to that as a practice, actually. I decided that any time my anger came up, I would be mindful of it. And, you know, the first time it happened, I still remember that first time it happened. I remember where I was. I was in the Peace Corps. I worked in a development bank, and I was sitting in front of my computer, and I woke up enraged. I remembered, I'm going to pay attention to anger when it comes. But the anger had made so much to do in my mind that I was really stuck in it by the time I woke up, by the time I remembered. And in that moment, it was kind of like, oh yeah, I said I was going to be aware of this. It was like, about all I could do was know, yep, that's anger. Miserable. This is unpleasant. I had very little tools, very little in the way of tools. I had this book, it said, Notice Your Anger. I didn't understand anything about directing attention to the body. I knew almost nothing. But in that moment, I saw, wow, this is unpleasant. And it's kind of like, well, what do I do with this? I don't know. I guess I go back to work. And in retrospect, thinking back on that moment, before I had remembered, I was sitting frozen in front of my computer. I was frozen in anger. I was not doing anything. I wasn't working. I was just spinning in my head. And in that moment of seeing the anger, recognizing it, noticing its unpleasantness, the mind had let go enough of it to be able to say, oh, I guess I go back to work. That's pretty amazing, actually, when I look back on it. Pretty amazing that simple little bit of recognition allowed enough space for me to let go of my anger to go back to work. And over the course of the next few weeks, I began to get tangible benefits from this very simple practice. So this is the way faith works. We begin to engage, And we begin to experience for ourselves, and it doesn't actually take that long if we observe what's happening in our minds. It doesn't take that long to recognize some of the benefits. Maybe getting a little bit of space, as I described a few minutes ago, a sense of, oh, here's anger again. And it's not quite so sticky for us. So we begin to examine the teachings in our own practice and get some sense of confidence, some sense of that verified faith that this is helpful. So many ways we might see this. I talked about the one about noticing, oh, this is just anger. This is just confusion. This is just whatever your thing is. Just being able to get that space around it. Sometimes we might start to see kind of causes and conditions related to our struggles. And this can give us a little bit of loosening of the identification around these patterns. On one long retreat, I was regularly experiencing loneliness and depression. At a certain point in the retreat, it kept coming back over and over again. And you know, it had been going along pretty well. You know, it was fall, the weather was beautiful, and walking outside, you know, that would lift my spirits. And then the weather turned, and it got really cold, and all the leaves fell off the trees, and I started walking in the basement in IMS, the retreat center where I was. I was walking in the basement of a kind of dark room with very few windows, very gray. Nobody else wanted to be down there, so I was all by myself. And I walked, I was, you know, kind of observing this loneliness and depression come and go. And one time I walked down the stairs into the basement and I felt it descend. I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I stood at the end of my walking path and I looked up out the little tiny window at the bare trees and the gray clouds. And I felt the sense of, the way my mind articulated it was something like, oh, this loneliness and depression has something to do with the weather. You know, it's like, and the way my mind said it is, this loneliness is as much the responsibility of the trees as it is of me. You know, and so I saw this interrelationship between the conditions of life and the arising of the state. Now, it didn't make it go away, but it sure helped me not feel like something, it was something I was doing wrong. You know, I could see that this was a condition. It was a conditioned experience. And I was actually contributing to the conditions by putting myself in an empty, very gray, dull room, not having any light. It's like, wow, okay, maybe I can do something about this, you know? Maybe I can bundle up and walk outside or do some walking elsewhere. So I began to see the causes and conditions. So seeing causes and conditions, this is seeing wisdom. This is wisdom at work. This is how wisdom helps to free us. So this is, you know, the willingness to observe begins to reveal these patterns. Sometimes when we're observing our shortcomings, I'll use Gil's word, when we're observing our shortcomings, we see the mindfulness gets really right there. And it's like in the very turning towards that shortcoming, it like disappears just in an instant. The first time this happened to me, I thought I did something wrong. I was, it was a feeling of abandonment that I was exploring. It was, again, I was at a 3-month course and I was between the two halves of the retreat. There's a 6-week retreat and there's a set of teachers on the first 6 weeks and a second 6 weeks in a largely different set of teachers on the second 6 weeks, and one of my teachers had left, and so I felt abandoned by that teacher. And I was going to be seeing a teacher that I'd never met before and felt a little bit of anxiety about seeing this teacher I'd never met before. And so in between courses, and I also didn't know if I was going to get to see the same teacher, the one that didn't leave. He had said in the hall he may not be seeing the people that he'd been seeing in the first half. And so I was like, oh, well, I may not even get to have that continuity. And so I was feeling really sorry for myself. And I was in the yoga room doing some stretching, and I was observing the feeling. You know, I was kind of aware of the sense of feeling abandoned, and I was using some tools. I recognized I felt really young. You know, I felt like I was about 4 years old, and part of my mind could be with that four-year-old with a sense of compassion. And so I was exploring that feeling of abandonment. And at some point, the mind just said, well, wow, what is this abandonment? And it got kind of curious and like just tried to turn right to the abandonment. And whew, there was nothing to see. It like vanished. And I went, huh. And I kind of got up and like, wow, wonder what I did wrong. the story I told myself is something like, I must not know how to observe emotions. That's what I told myself in my mind. And then a couple of days later, I went to my new teacher, the new teacher, and I said, you know, I don't think I know how to observe emotions. You know, I had this experience, and I described this disappearance of the emotion. And I said, I came up with this whole story. And she said, well, was that your experience? I said, no, my experience was it vanished. And she said, trust your experience. That was a huge teaching for me. Trust your experience. So sometimes the mindfulness can simply meet. And she said something like, sometimes even the, hanging out with an experience is kind of somehow, bringing it along. And, you know, my understanding in retrospect now is kind of the curiosity of like, well, what is this anyway? As opposed to, oh, I feel so bad. I feel so lonely. I'm abandoned. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, knowing abandoned. Instead, this curiosity was, what is this abandonment? That put the mind into a kind of a more interested space. And then there was nothing to see. So sometimes wisdom works that way. Sometimes wisdom just cuts right through these shortcomings. Now, of course, it's not like they go away forever. This is something we really have to accept in our practice. You know, we have an insight like that, you know. Sometimes we really so clearly see into something. I had another one of those insights around self-hatred, and it was like, whew, in a moment, the self-hatred vanished. And then, you know, it was like a moment of bliss. Immediately following, I went from self-hatred to bliss in a split second, and the mind said, oh, never again. I'll never feel self-hatred again. But I had seen the pattern enough to have a little bit of balanced mind come in and say, no, this is the understanding in this moment. In this moment, the mind understands something about self-hatred and can release it. It may not be forever. It may not be that conditions will always be that way. So this is something we have to, a pattern in our practice that we have to accept and embrace. That insights are impermanent. Insights come and go. And the conditions that allow us to see through something really clearly in a moment. It's a coming together of many conditions, a lot of which has to do with the power of mindfulness in that moment and the power of the understanding that's present in the mind at that moment. So it's wisdom and mindfulness together, the conditions for that, allowing that freedom, that seeing. There are so many times when conditions don't support that depth of mindfulness. And when that happens, we work with, maybe we can say, oh, this is anger. Okay, this is just anger. Maybe we use the tools like I was using. Okay, can I bring some compassion to this? Knowing when it's too much, when is it time to say, I see you and let go. I see you and let go. I see you and let me turn to something else. When is it time to do that? Over time, initially, you know, the first few times this happens when we see something so clearly and then we think, oh, I figured it out. You know, it's like we have this recognition and it's like, wow, I'm never going to be caught by that again, because we're used to knowledge and wisdom functioning in something that we can just like put down and pick up and put down and pick up. The wisdom of our practice isn't quite that simple. It's like we can't just like turn and go, oh, right, I remember that. I can regurgitate that. Last time I had this experience, I turned to it with compassion first, and then the mind got curious and, you know, try to pick that up and walk ourselves through those steps. You know, you might get some sense of benefit of those, but it may not create the same conditions. And so sometimes we can doubt those insights because they're impermanent. And the first few times we have that experience of, you know, like something comes back a second time, a third time, and we think, oh, wait, you know, I saw through this. Why is it back? You know, why am I feeling anger again? Why is self-hatred coming back? I saw through this 3 weeks ago. What's the problem? When we first start seeing through things in that clear way, we may have that relationship and think, well, I guess I really didn't see through it before. We can doubt that insight. But over time, we begin to understand how, or the conditioned nature of that wisdom and mindfulness coming together and allowing us to see through things. And so we begin to just ride our waves of the practice. Sometimes we can be with things. Sometimes we have to set them aside. Sometimes mindfulness can be really penetrating. So over time, we start to trust this cycle and to trust our insights, to trust that, yes, that was a clear seeing. My teacher said, trust your experience. We will second guess. So much of the path unfolds in a gradual way. You know, these kind of clear insights that we talk about, or, you know, those are the kind of insights that's what I thought insight practice was about. And, you know, I figured there'd be one really big insight and, like, you know, after that, it'd be like everything would be great. And I've had a few of the kind of insights where it's like something is like it's a knife that just comes whew, and the mind just sees something so clearly and releases it, and there's just no problem, no issue. A few of those. I can probably count the number of those on two hands. Largely, the way the practice unfolds is in a gradual way. As Gil said, no moment of mindfulness is wasted. It kind of begins to wear away. This mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness, the way we're exploring it, trying to hold things lightly, not gripping, not pushing away, but just holding. That practice wears away at these shortcomings in a very gradual way. The Buddha used an analogy of a wearing away of parts of a ship, a shipwreck. He talked about a shipwreck and the parts of the ship strewn about the beach. He said, every day the sun, the sand, the wind wear away at those parts. You know, and thinking about that analogy, the Buddha's analogies are pretty amazing. They have a lot to them. You can reflect on them. You can reflect on the imagery. And in reflecting on that imagery, I thought, yeah, you know, each day I come back and look at those parts on the beach, there's not going to be much difference. I look back, you know, if I go each day and look, okay, rope, have you rotted yet? You know, I'm not going to see much difference day to day. But after 6 months or a year, if I try to pick that rope up, it'll fall apart. And it will have fallen apart through that gradual wearing away. Sometimes the verified faith, the verified wisdom, comes not from seeing something vanish in a split second like that, but from recognizing almost after the fact, wow, I'm not reacting the way I used to. You know, we see the absence of reactivity. It's not something like really mind-blowing. It's just like, huh, you know, gosh, I know if I'd been doing this 3 years ago and this situation had happened, I would be really torqued out right now. But gosh, it's just, it's okay. I'm a little bit agitated. So we see the absence of the reactivity. And that's a way, too, that our faith can be verified. This is one really great support for our faith, to reflect on what are the benefits you have gained from your practice. Remind yourself, if it feels like, gosh, you know, I'm just not making any progress, or, you know, day by day, remember, day by day, it's unlikely that we'll see any measurable progress. But reflect back over weeks or months or years of your practice and check in. What have you learned? What are the benefits? That will support your sense of confidence in the practice. So this verified faith, this may sound like in the terrain of, and it is beginning to be in the terrain of this unshakable faith. You know, when we see for ourselves the wisdom, when we know for ourselves the value of this practice, we're likely to keep going. You know, that's how faith fuels the practice. We begin, we gain some of the wisdom, and that gaining of wisdom encourages us, like, wow, you know, the way it was articulated in my mind is, wow, this stuff works. I'm going to keep doing this. And it's like the little tastes of freedom were so nurturing and so supportive of wanting to continue. So the verified faith initially, early on, it's like verifying aspects of the teaching, aspects of the path. We may gain some confidence, for instance, in particular tools. We may gain confidence in the practice of mindfulness. Or we may gain confidence in the practice of kindness, of friendliness, or of generosity. We see how these tools support us. So while we may gain some confidence and see for ourselves, and we get a taste for ourselves of how helpful these tools are, we don't question applying them again. But we may still not have the unwavering confidence, unshakable confidence, in the possibility of complete freedom. That's my understanding of what unshakable confidence is, this avecchaprasada that's referred to in the sutta. Unshakable confidence is complete confidence in the possibility for full freedom from suffering. In my own practice, you know, I began to sense and get a flavor of, wow, doing this, I see the possibility for being really much less angry in my life. But no anger? I don't know about that. So the verified faith, it's like just little tastes of hints of the possibility. With unshakable faith, there is a deep sense of confidence, of trust, of knowing the possibility for complete freedom. Complete freedom, the definition that is offered. There's a couple different definitions that the Buddha offers us. The main one of I'll offer you three. One is the ending of craving. That's the tie to the Four Noble Truths. In the Third Noble Truth, the statement of freedom from suffering, the freedom from craving is the ending. The freedom from suffering is the freedom from craving. That's freedom. So that's one way it's stated. Free from that kind of urge to fill a hole. Urge to fill, you know, to say something is going to do it for me. Something out there. Back to the Brahmin in our sutta who was trying to search for freedom outside of himself. Bathing in that river, that's what's going to do it for me. So coming back into ourselves, the release from craving. That's one of the ways it's defined. Another way the Buddha defines it is the ending of greed, the ending of aversion, the ending of delusion. Three roots of our unwholesome, unskillful states of mind. A more perhaps accessible definition, one that I find inspiring. The Buddha says, when one is freed, when greed, aversion, and delusion are given up, one experiences no mental pain or grief. It's not saying there's not going to be any physical pain. There may well be physical pain, but no mental pain or grief. In this very life, that possibility of no mental pain and grief. Do we have unshakable confidence in that possibility? The possibility that of a mind so at ease that nothing will shake it. Now, our initial thinking of that, you know, might be someone who doesn't feel anything. You know, we might have that idea that no mental pain and grief means indifference. But my understanding of that and my little glimpses of the mind that is non-reactive is that mind that's non-reactive is not indifferent. It actually is huge. It can meet the suffering of the world. It feels the suffering of the world very deeply. It's not thrown off by it. It feels the joy of the world very deeply. It's not thrown off by it. It's not aversive to the suffering. It's not wanting to hold on to the joy. The mind that has that balance actually feels more deeply. And those emotions we'll talk about in a couple of days, the emotions of the awakened heart are love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. It's not a mind that feels nothing. It's a mind that feels more deeply and is not reactive to it.
So coming back to our sutta, I was thinking about this inner bathing analogy and reflecting on the first section around knowing and understanding our shortcomings. That could be looked at as an inner bathing. We bathe in mindfulness. You can even think of it almost like an analogy of washing clothes. You know, you put stained or dirty laundry in the washing machine and add the water and add the soap. You're bathing the clothes in that soap and water. And what happens there with the soap? The soap has a chemical reaction with the dirt, and it attracts the dirt. It actually pulls it out of the clothes so that the dirt comes into the water so that it can be rinsed away. And kind of likewise with mindfulness. Mindfulness is kind of like the water in the soap. We bathe these shortcomings. We bathe our minds in this soap and water of mindfulness, and it attracts the shortcomings. It pulls them into consciousness. Some of you have even mentioned this. You know, it's like, I didn't know I was so anxious. You know, the mindfulness practice isn't creating the shortcomings, it's revealing them. And it's good news that they're being revealed, because it's like they're coming out into the wash so that they can be released. As long as they are under the surface of consciousness, they're going to be kind of, we're going to be acting out of those because they're not clear for us. So the mindfulness serves to allow these shortcomings to be known in awareness. It doesn't feel good at first, although we do start to recognize and appreciate the joy of seeing, the joy of knowing, essentially, that this kind of suffering, sometimes it's said this kind of suffering that we experience with mindfulness, as we witness our shortcomings with mindfulness, that's the kind of suffering that leads to the end of suffering. Because when the shortcomings are brought into consciousness, there's the possibility of release, of abandonment. When they're not seen, it's hard to abandon them. And so the first part of the bathing is bathing in this knowing, the inner bathing, bathing in this mindfulness and wisdom, allowing it to help to release these shortcomings. And with that release comes this confidence. And then we can bathe in that confidence, bathe in that sense of trust in the practice. That inspires us to move more deeply, not to just know the possibility, not to just have confidence in the possibility for freedom from suffering, but to engage in the direction that will take us to that for ourselves. And that's where Gil will pick up tomorrow. So let's just sit for a minute.